Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
In association with Viatel Technology Group, IT leaders breathe easy with Viatel Managed Cybersecurity. Viatel.com.
This is News Talk.
Yeah, you're very welcome along. Coming up over the next hour, John Riley is going to be here to look at the impact of AI on gaming. Ciara O'Brien will explain the latest headache facing Apple. And as ever, I'll answer your tech questions. If you want to get in touch, you can drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram at JessKellyNT. But we're going to start this week with the world of gaming. John Riley of TheEffect.net is with me now. John, how are you?
Good. How are you, Jess?
I'm good. It's been a while since we've spoken, and every single day, different bits of gaming news are popping up in my feed. And it's kind of baffling how the majority of the headlines feature AI. It seems like AI is going to be a real disruptor, whether it's good or bad, I don't know yet, but in the world of gaming.
Well, like we know in general, AI is disrupting almost every industry. So I don't necessarily see why gaming wouldn't really be the next one. If anything, it's probably been using it longer than a lot of other industries. But yeah, it's really coming to a fore now. And unfortunately, I guess from the creativity aspect and of game development, the use of AI, like any other entertainment industry, is seen with a bit of a negative hue because you're taking away jobs, you know, in inverted commas, or you could be. Again, it's the early days of AI for everything. So its implementation into game development is also in early stages. But, you know, people are seeing it being used for, you know, for script writing for characters that aren't maybe the lead character, for kind of audio dialogue changing, that you could have someone's voice that would be kind of done with an AI voice, so you wouldn't have to pay voice actors, all these kind of things. It is, you know, so I guess, you know, we had the big writer's strike in America there last year into, I think, maybe early this year. And how that was, in, you know, there was an AI subcategory to that whole kind of agreement that, you know, voice actors and actors in general, their likenesses were protected when it came to AI kind of use and replication across kind of various forms of media. So yeah, it's definitely interesting times ahead.
Yeah, it's definitely a disruptor. And I suppose what I'm trying to get my head around at the moment is trying to find the optimistic side to all of this. So as a gamer and as fans of the different games, the different productions, we've spoken so many times about the quality of some of the productions. There's some of the games that you've spoken about that are more akin to, you know, I don't know, like Star Wars franchise movies more so than just titles. So how, when, where and why will AI be used to kick on the gaming offerings, making you, the gaming fan, that bit happier?
Yeah, that's, like, as I said, I think it's been used, like AI in general, again, has been used more than we like to think across industries, and gaming is no different. That, you know, it's just, it's, it becomes the everyday. It's no longer kind of a new and novel experience. But just this week, actually, Game Developer Conference, so right on the money in terms of the people that are kind of implementing these ideas into kind of how games are made, took place in San Francisco. So GDC, it's known for short, had a number of different showcases happening at the event. And NVIDIA, they're one of the biggest kind of computer graphics card manufacturers, AI data center creators in the world. Their stocks are spiking given their kind of the use of their graphics cards to process these large language models for kind of various AI applications. But in particular, for this game developer conference, they focused on how AI can use for game development. So obviously, so there was a demo showed called Covert Protocol, and this was developed by a company, an AI powered game company or game startup called, let me get this right now, they were called InWorld AI. So these guys showed off this thing called Covert Protocol, and it was like this really futuristic looking hotel lobby with a bar and whatever else you're having. And there was characters dotted around this lobby, like a bartender and a kind of a businessman. But all these guys, their movements, their dialogue, their lip syncing, as in how their face actually moved, everything was done by AI. So that, to imagine a computer is developing something as comprehensive as that, or that AI is developing something as comprehensive as that, is quite unprecedented. But, you know, seeing it in action, it shows you a lot of the pitfalls yet to be covered or to be crossed when it comes to this kind of content being created purely by AI.
Mm. Yeah, one of the things that I know you hate when I mention it because I've been bringing it up for about 27 years now. But you remember when Cyberpunks came out, right? And there was all that controversy because it wasn't as polished and ready and there was bugs and all the rest. The gaming community wasn't very forgiving. Now, I know things have moved on and bridges have been built. But in terms of embracing innovative technology in ways that it hasn't been done before, because as you correctly point out, you know, AI has been used for yonks now in the world of gaming. But I suppose, how long before we see this real innovation that will reimagine gaming as a result of artificial intelligence?
I think we're quite a number of years off, because it's never really going to be. There might be a moment where a game will be hailed as the first AI generated game, like the first movie we're going to, you know, Toy Story was the first ever computer generated film. Before that, people didn't think it was possible. So it's only a matter of when. But in terms of the first game being announced as the first AI fully created game, we are a significant amount of time from anything of proper polish and quality to be kind of there. There might be indie titles that will come down the track, smaller titles that will kind of show us the early stages. As I said, the demo was showed off during the week in San Francisco. But I think behind the scenes, as I said earlier, AI has already been used to help kind of tidy up how games are made, kind of the bricks and mortar, the stuff you don't see on the surface. So it is helping with character animations and how they move about environments. To your point, Cyberpunk, now, I think the issue there was AI wasn't where it needed to be to help kind of speed up the process of the, what would you call it, the quality control near the end of the title. I think this game was rushed out, unfortunately, when it was rushed in 2020, and they just didn't have the implementation of AI to kind of be able to kind of clean up a lot of the rough edges of that game. So that is kind of something that they may not, you know, think from the rooftops, these game developers, but behind the scenes, AI might be doing a lot of heavy lifting to help these people along this quality control process and kind of just the background stuff you're never going to see. So I would like to hope it's not only going to help speed up kind of the development of these AAA titles, but also just ensure that they're a much higher quality than the likes of Cyberpunk when it launched. But unfortunately, my pessimistic hat being put on, I think the reason AI is being forced into use or into its being applied to all these different game developer studios is for cost effective measures too, just to kind of cut down on hours being spent by people tidying up a game when AI can do it for next to nothing. So there's a double-edged sword there.
Yeah, there is, particularly as you alluded to at the top, you know, when jobs are at stake. But I do think, you know, like you've told us before about how a game can be in development for years. Like it's not a 6-month project. This is something that takes an awful lot of time. And so from a fan point of view, from a business point of view, from so many different, I suppose, vantage points, the use and the application of AI does make sense.
Yeah, it's an inevitability. It's not going to be implemented. And as I said, it is already happening. Unity is another huge game engine producer, game publisher, even along the same lines of Nvidia or of Unreal, who make Fortnite. So Unity at this event at GDC did publish a kind of an AI report that did show, look at it, is being used. 71%, I think, of studios are using it for this background content. It's going to start to become more apparent, you know, that I think people are using it as a buzzword. You know, this event showcased this video, this tech demo I spoke about, as a kind of a, ooh, look at this AI, isn't this hot topic? Look at these characters talking to me, and nobody wrote that script for that character. And you're like, yeah, I enjoy that it's a proof of concept, but it looks awful. And there's no way, you know, that game does not look good. And the characters are like weirdly robotic, unsurprisingly, because of the content that's been written for them and how their faces are moving. It's almost like I was surprised they showcased this as a kind of a demo, because it did not show its benefits or it's why it would be something you as a developer or any game developer out there would want to go, yeah, that looks like I want to make a game that looks just as bad as that. So yeah. I think it definitely needs a lot more time in the oven. And yeah, like other studios have come out also saying they're using it for NPC dialogue, so non-playable characters, so the guys in the background of your Spider-Man game that are walking down the street or whatever it may be, to kind of, again, write their dialogue, write their movements. But people are like, no, just, you don't need to tell us. Basically, it's almost like ignorance is bliss, because you're taking a job away from a scriptwriter, from extras, or from, you know, character extras that would be recorded their voices for those people in the street, whatever it may be. So, yeah, I think companies need to be careful how they are promoting their use of AI, to be honest.
Yeah, and also, if I can just borrow your cynic's hat for a moment, the thing that I've been thinking about is, like, I can see the benefits of it, right? But say if you're a parent and you're the parent of a gamer, you don't necessarily know what characters could come out with, because if it hasn't gone through the same vetting process, or if it is open to interpretation, the ratings that come on games, it's going to create quite a few headaches, I'd imagine.
That's a really good point, actually. Yeah, that's like, because up to this point, for the vast majority of game development, all that dialogue would have been scripted by a human. It would have been, there is headlines that came out over the years of these massive RPG or role-playing games that had, you know, like Grand Theft Auto, that's not an RPG as such, but Grand Theft Auto titles having 100,000 lines of dialogue for all those characters, as you said, walking down the street. But if AI is going to be writing that in the future, that, you know, you'd imagine they're going to be vetted, each line that actually is put into the game as audio. But there's going to be, we're going to see those headlines, to your point, that game is, you know, has racist people in the street, or it's whatever else you're having, something that's going to create a very salacious headline. So the quality control will be, you know, they're going to save money and time in one corner, but then they're going to have to get vetters and people make, you know, quality testing to make sure that the computer, those characters aren't saying something they shouldn't or doing something they shouldn't even. Age rating thing is going to have to be potentially, well, I don't say readjusted, but reevaluated for sure.
Yeah. Oh, I love these little quandaries.
We are at such a turning point with AI. Yeah. So like, yeah, gaming is the biggest entertainment industry in the world. The money that's in there is bonkers and bananas. And to see that AI is being used isn't a shock, but just to make sure it's used the right way is really going to dictate its application into the future.
Yeah. Another way it's rumoured or thought to be used is in the rumoured or thought to be PS5 Pro. What do we know about the PS5 Pro before we get to the AI bits?
Yeah, so it's like it's falling in line with what PlayStation did with the PS4. So that originally launched in 2014 along with the Xbox One. And then about 3 years later in 2016, we got what was called the PS4 Pro. So to general listener, it literally is it's a souped up PlayStation. It's not necessarily going to be a brand, it is a new console per se, but it's in the same family of the PS5 that came out in 2020. So you're not going to get games that are going to be made exclusively for this new console that is rumored to come out later this year. And the rumors are pretty apparent now online, and they're pretty, that a lot of them are being kind of double checked and cross checked. So as much as Sony probably don't want us to be talking about this rumored console for fear that it'll kill their sales up until its official announcement, or sales of the PS4, should I say, or PS5, that, yeah, this new console is going to be a hell of a lot more powerful. Games are going to just look that bit better. Again, me, I'm in my element hearing this kind of thing, but to some general listeners, they'd be like, I just bought the PS5 when it became available 2 years after it launched. There's no way I'm buying a new PS5. So they're going to be up against that kind of quandary of the availability back when the console's launched to what is now 4 years later.
Yeah, and I suppose that is a fair point, because it caused such a hullabaloo at the time. So I'd understand and empathise with that pain point. But the talk of the utilising of AI to make it even better again, like, is it not all right as it is?
I was just thinking about that before I came on this call, and you're absolutely right. It's, you know, the consoles have always been playing catch up, to the PC race, or to the PC generation or PC industry, because you know, if you're a PC gamer, you are upgrading your graphics card almost once a year, which is basically this big honking thing that you stick into the side of your desktop or whatever it may be, to give you the better, more powerful graphics cards so your games can look that bit prettier. So that's like an almost annual cyclical thing. Whereas these consoles, as I said, they're looking, you know, this isn't the first time they've done this mid-gen refresh. As I said, last generation, they did it with the PS4 Pro, and then the Xbox Series X, no, the Xbox One X was their jump up. So now here we are with PS5 doing it. It is going to give us better visuals, and AI is really coming to a fore here now. And that's the point I was trying to get to, is that the likes of Nvidia, who I mentioned showcasing at GDC this week, they are the leaders when it comes to graphics cards for PC gaming. And they've been using AI to help their graphics cards work smarter, not harder, basically. So instead of putting in sheer brute force of processing power, they're using AI to help generate, it's called frame generation. So, you know, people, when people are playing a game, it's usually 30 frames per second or 60 frames per second. And if you're playing it at twice the frame rate, you're getting a smoother, more interactive, more immersive experience, more responsive experience. So the PS5 Pro is looking to deliver that at higher resolution. So AI is going to help to insert these kind of AI generated frames to double your frame rate, quadruple your frame rate, whatever it may be, depending on the title. So you're going to get a much more responsive, much more fluid gaming experience at still 4K resolution, if not 4K higher. 8K has been rumored for this new PS5. So your games are going to look smoother. They're going to look sharper. Ray tracing, I'm not sure if we spoke about in the past. It's a new way of lighting your game. It's like, The lighting within the worlds you're playing in is going to be a hell of a lot more realistic. The shadows, the reflections. I think I spoke about it a while back. Spider-Man, you're swinging around New York with the PS5. You now have all your reflections of all your fancy skyscrapers. Again, doesn't really need, you do not need it, but it just makes it that bit more immersive when you are trying to kind of become Spider-Man or become the character you're playing. So yeah, it's just going to be a really powerful PS5. Gives you better graphics.
Okay, and I wonder, and I don't want to be that person, but I will, like, why don't they hold this for a PS6 and just reimagine the entire thing? Like, do we have to go through those long life cycles for each iteration?
I think they just know they're probably losing market share to people that see these new titles that are coming out on PC, on PS5 and on Xbox Series X and S. And people are seeing that the PC has the best visual features, the best frame rate, that they're like, well, we're missing a trick here. We've got a captive audience that love their PS5s, PlayStation fanboys. And we've got our exclusive titles that can only be played on PS5. So let's really force people. Not force, but entice people to get the best visuals possible. Not only, again, for their first-party titles, but Grand Theft Auto 5, one of the biggest games that will ever launch this decade, is going to come out next year. And rumors, again, are all connecting GTA 5's launch to the PS5 Pro, given that you're probably going to get the best gaming experience on a console if you're playing GTA 5, or GTA 6, should I say, on the PS5 Pro. So there's that kind of, people want to have the best experience possible. Mm. And Rockstar, more than anyone, is one of the biggest publishers in the world. And they always seem to launch their latest title, which will be GTA 6, on consoles first, with quite an extended delay before it makes its way to PC. So really, it's only going to be a console game next year when it comes out. Everybody in the world is going to want to play it on their console. And if the PS5 Pro is the most powerful one available, that's going to put sales through the roof. So it's all this kind of jumping on bandwagons, offering the best possible visual clarity for people that want it but don't want to be a PC gamer or don't have the games they want to play on PC. It's all that kind of rigmarole as well. So yeah, it's a bit of a funny one.
Oh, okay.
I get your I really do. And a lot of listeners will be like, there's not a chance I'm buying it. I will. That's just, again,
that doesn't surprise me, John. That's not breaking news.
I should have said I wasn't going to buy it. But yeah, let's not be surprised here. Exactly. There's a reason I'm on talking about this like a nerd, that I'm going to be picking up the PS5 Pro if it does launch as it's expected to launch or rumored to be launched later this year. Because I just love when gaming is pushed forward, console gaming in particular, and I get to have the best visuals possible to be immersed as much as possible.
Well, we will, of course, bring you all of the updates and we'll try and capture John's excitement if and when it's announced. If you do have any gaming questions or if there's a title you want us to review, you can email techtalk@newstalk.com. And don't forget, you can go to theeffect.net for all of the gaming reviews as well as other tech news as well. For the moment, John Riley, thanks so much.
Thanks a million, Jess.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. As ever, if you want to get in touch, you can drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com. I posted on Instagram earlier this week that I'd read Fool Me Once by Harlan Coben. I was off for a few days this week, so I downloaded the book onto my Kindle. And I've read a few of those books, the Harlan Coben books. Some of them are great, some of them are grand. This one was in the grand category. There were, I would argue, as a non-writer, plot holes left, right and centre. But I asked my followers on Instagram if it's worth watching the TV show starring Michelle Keegan. This was doing the rounds on Netflix a little while ago. It was the number one show. If you didn't watch it at the time, here's just a snippet of it.
Lily, Did you see Daddy?
Daddy.
Did you see Daddy yesterday when I wasn't here? He came over and he gave you a cuddle and he sat you on his lap. Okay. Right, Mummy's being silly, I'm sorry.
Mrs. Perkins?
Can I speak with you?
Now?
Yes, now. I need to show you something.
What is this?
It's a camera.
You record me?
I just watch your screen.
You're spying on me?
Watch. How do you explain this?
I don't know what you mean.
That man there, you saw him. You saw who that was.
Who?
What do you mean? Who? It's Joe. How the hell can that be?
Please, Mrs. Burkett, you're scaring me.
Yeah, that's a snippet of Fool Me Once from Netflix, which is based on the book by Harlan Coben. I read the book, as I said there a second ago, and it was grand. But I don't know if I should watch the TV show or not. A lot of people were divided when I asked Instagram. Some people saying, yeah, it's fine. It's chewing gum for the brain kind of stuff. Other people saying it's utterly appalling and avoid it like the plague. But what I've realised is I desperately need a bingeable show. I feel like I've watched everything that could be watched. If you have any recommendations, what's a good series? Like, I need a new Sopranos. I need a new Succession. I need something meaty. I don't mind if it's old, but I just need something to get stuck into. So if you have any recommendations, will you please let me know? Email me techtalk@newstalk.com. What I have been doing, however, since I finished that book by Harlan Coben, is reading Small Fry by Lisa Brennan-Jobs. This is our book club pick, chosen by Cameron Hill, and we're going to be reviewing it in 2 weeks' time on the programme. Lisa Brennan-Jobs, for those who don't know, is the daughter of Steve Jobs. You know that dude from Apple? And it's telling the story from her perspective. I've actually been listening to it on Audible because I subscribe to Audible Unlimited and it's actually free. So it's not using one of my credits, which is great. And I don't want to spoil it by giving away my hot takes already, but it is quite interesting and I would definitely recommend you get on board. And if you're going to read along with us, you can send over your thoughts again for the 75th time in 6 minutes. The email is techtalk@newstalk.com. But I want to stick with Apple for a moment because the company is facing yet another headache. There was a headline on The Verge this week that read, US sues Apple for illegal monopoly over smartphones. Apple hasn't been having a great time of it recently. They've just been facing one issue after another. Ciara O'Brien of the Irish Times is with me now. Ciara, like, what's the story here? What's going on?
What they're saying is that Apple is kind of creating an illegal monopoly in smartphones, that they are effectively locking out their competitors. And as a result, that is choking innovation. And it's also keeping prices high. You know, and if a lot of this sounds familiar, I mean, it's the same kind of thing we've heard from the EU when it came to implementing the new Digital Markets Act, which is not just aimed at Apple, obviously, but, you know, Apple has obviously been one of the key companies that we've been talking about under this new act. So this is a US action, and it's been coming for a while. They've been talking about it for a while. I mean, if you look over the last couple of years, there was kind of hints, you know, that this type of action was coming, that, you know, the Department of Justice was going to take a tougher line against companies on the antitrust front. And it's very familiar if you're old enough to remember when Microsoft was the one that was under the microscope when it came to kind of these type of practices. But now it's Apple's turn in the spotlight on both sides of the Atlantic, it seems.
Mm. And like the thing that I like, obviously, from a consumer point of view, I think it's great if there's more freedom, if there's more choice, if there's lower prices. But from a business point of view, Apple has always been very protective over its ecosystem, more so, I would argue, than any tech brand. So is this not a bit late in the day to be raising these kind of flags?
Well, I don't think it's ever a too late point to raise those flags, because I suppose the problem with these cases is, you know, the companies have to be big enough for them to actually have a monopoly. So you could argue that once they're big enough that they actually do have what the Department of Justice or the EU determines is a monopoly on a market, or that they are behaving in an anti-competitive way, that it's too late. You know, that's already there. It's kind of like a catch-22 situation. They have to be big enough to bring this case to argue that there is a monopoly, but at the same time, you know, the monopoly has to be there, which is obviously bad for consumers. And, you know, you can never really say that it's, you know, it's too late to be raising flags about it, because that's just throwing our hands in the air and saying, you know, we give up, which obviously, you know, the authorities are not known for doing, particularly when it comes to things like this. And if they had taken the same line, say, with Microsoft and with Google on various kind of antitrust probes in the past, well, you know, I think the tech landscape would be very different. Now, I think it's worth noting as well that Apple is obviously kind of it's arguing against all of these charges. I mean, there's particular, I suppose, emphasis on stuff like, you know, the fact that Apple restricts access to, you know, third party payments systems. You know, if you have an iPhone, you have Apple Wallet, and there's very limited situations in which other companies can access the NFC on an iPhone. Now, obviously, that is something as well that's been raised under the DMA in the EU. So, you know, it's come up again in the US. So obviously, this is a target for authorities. They want to see more competition there. There's also the messaging system. So, you know, the iMessage, they're basically saying, you know, that it's locking people out, it's locking competitors out, because we have, you know, this green and blue message. And there's been many an argument put forward about how this whole idea of, you know, Apple having its own iMessage system that lock, you know, and everybody else has those green bubbles instead of blue bubbles. Yeah, I don't know how well that one is going to fly. I don't think it's particularly with the existence of kind of other third-party messaging systems. I don't know very many people who use text messaging and iMessage exclusively, put it that way. Most people would use kind of some sort of third-party messaging system, whether it's WhatsApp, whether it's Signal or Telegram, stuff like that. You know, so you're not solely limited to SMS and iMessage. Then I suppose, you know, we've seen over the past few weeks how the authorities here are tackling this whole issue of Apple's dominance in the market. Now, this is the first shot across the bow in the US. It's very much very early days. You know, you're not going to see any resolution to this in the next year or so. And then even at that point, it will drag on and on with appeals and appeals after appeals. So, you know, it's still very early days. And there's a lot of road left to run between now and the conclusion of this case.
And let's just strip it back for a second, because you and I are obviously big tech fans. And part of our jobs is that we have to play with all of these phones. And we've said on this programme before that it's getting increasingly difficult to talk about a new iPhone or a new Samsung phone in a way that we haven't done at some point over our 20-year careers or whatever it is now. Like, if these changes come into play, from an innovation point of view, is it not going to get more boring that every phone is going to be exactly the same? They're all going to be not quite open source, but you know what I mean? They're all going to have access to the same features. That thing that makes iPhone different to Samsung, different to Huawei, different to Xiaomi, is going to slowly fade away.
Yeah, you could. I mean, you could argue that. You could also argue that it will make them more innovative because they will have to stand out from the pack. I mean, we've seen it with phones in the past. Like, we all had those tiny phones. Then we went to bigger, you know, touchscreen phones. And, you know, there have been some changes, and not all led by Apple. You know, sometimes Apple follows, you know, when the market is established, but does it in a way that appeals to its users. And part of the appeal for a lot of people with Apple has been this walled garden thing, you know, so they know that if they download an app from the App Store, that, you know, that it's been through a certain level of checks. You know, obviously in the EU, that's now opening up to third party app stores because of the DMA, and things are getting, I suppose, yeah, things will, to a certain extent, become a bit samey, but at the same time, it may bring new people in and new things in for the iPhone that wasn't possible before. I mean, look, there is a certain amount of, you know, of kind of repetition in the market. You know, we see this happening all the time. You know, I've lost track of the amount of times hardcore Apple fans have, you know, gone absolutely nuts about a new feature, only for the Android fanboys to turn around and say, well, actually, we've had that for a long time. and vice versa. You know, they both feed into each other. So you could argue that they've both been kind of getting a bit more samey anyway over the past couple of years, and this will it may make it more kind of homogenous initially, but that it could also kind of spur innovation because people will be able to do more on an Apple platform than they were able to do prior to all these actions taking place. I mean, particularly in the EU, you know, because there is that level of openness. But yeah, I mean, look, absolutely massively regret, you know, even kind of backing this in anyway. But I do think that openness tends to be better in some ways. I mean, look, we have this with the, as I said, in the EU, we have the DMA, we have these third party app stores that are going to be coming to the iPhone. And from a parent's point of view, because I have two young kids, and from a parent's point of view, having that control over what is on their phones, you know, and when I say phones, I as I said, I have two young kids. They don't have their own phone with the SIM card that they have unfettered access to, but I have very tightly controlled devices that they can use occasionally, you know, if they want to get half an hour of screen time, you know, that they can use these phones. But everything is locked down very tightly, you know, so in-app purchases are locked out. The actual time they're allowed on the phones is severely limited as well. The problem is then once you open that up, obviously some of those parental controls have to be loosened a little bit because you can't control what goes on in through the Apple system in a third party store. I mean, I'd have to block out, you know, in-app purchases in other third party stores rather than having one central place where I can do it. So, you know, how that works is, you know, we're going to find that out in the next, I suppose, the next few months as these new stores come on stream. But, you know, there are pros and cons to everything, and nothing is always 100% good, and neither is it 100% bad. So it is one of those things I'm going to reserve judgment on, and we'll see how it goes. But yeah, I mean, it's going to be an interesting time ahead, I think, for sure.
Yeah, no, definitely. The other thing that you just hit upon there in the context of kids, but also for adults as well, is the safety of the device. Like Apple, do you remember a few years ago they went on this big hoo-ha about the safety and security of iPhone and the importance of encryption and the importance of encryption on iCloud and all that kind of jazz? Like, it's going to be vital that as whatever changes come down the track are implemented, that safety and cybersecurity are at the core.
Absolutely. And you know, Apple has been very vocal on its record in the past, and people do have a certain amount of trust in it because, you know, a lot of their services are subscription services. So, you know, there's a certain amount of confidence that comes with that because, you know, the saying is when the product is free, you're the product. If you're paying for a service, well, at least you know that your data, for the most part, is not being used in a way that, you know, that you don't anticipate. And I think that, yes, it is going to be a bit more difficult to guarantee safety and security on platforms when they are more open. Apple does have a system in place where, you know, like similar to what it does with Macs, where there's kind of a notarization process where software is automatically scanned and, you know, things will have to be reviewed, you know, before they have access to certain systems on the iPhone anyway. I mean, they're not just going to allow unfettered access. There will be a certain amount of, I suppose, scanning for malware and stuff like that. But once you loosen the controls in any way, it does open the door, even a chink. And that is, you know, something that people need to be aware of, you know, when they are using third-party app stores. I mean, you get the same thing with Android. When you go on to, you download stuff from Google Play, that's fine. If you go outside of Google Play and you disable some of the security controls that prevent you from installing apps from what the system terms unknown sources, you will get a warning, you know, that you could be downloading stuff that you're not sure about, that you don't know is you could be downloading something that you think is a genuine app, but has actually got a whole load of malware on board. So it's not something that if you've ever used Android or any other, I suppose, any other system outside of Apple, you'd be well aware that sometimes apps can come with a hidden surprise inside, I suppose, less pleasant than a Kinder Egg. But, you know, people will just have to be more aware. And I think people are generally becoming more aware of cybersecurity and more on their guard because we are entering an age where, you know, deep fakes are possible, you know, for even for the average person. It's not just about celebrities, where, you know, your face could be spoofed to try and get around a fintech's or banking app's security, you know. And this is going to become more and more, I suppose, more and more of a threat as we go on. So people are becoming more cynical, and that in this case is a good thing, you know. But I just think it is something that people will have to get up to speed with very, very quickly.
Yeah, and I suppose my final question on this for now, and I don't know that you would necessarily have the inside track, but I'll ask the question anyway. Do you think that these changes that are happening on a sort of software and a background level will force Apple to innovate in a more exciting way when it comes to the physical devices? Because we haven't had, like you and I were talking around the time of the last few iPhones, like on this program, and every time we say, yeah, it doesn't look that different from the 12, the 13, the 14, whatever. Do you think that we're going to see some dramatic innovation from them to showcase that they are more than their operating system and they are more than what we've seen to date?
I think Apple will continue to be Apple in that, you know, they've always differentiated themselves in terms of hardware quality, and, you know, they will continue to do that. And look, we're going to see new products, and you know, we've seen the Apple Vision Pro. I think we're probably going to see more of an emphasis on AI. That's the way most companies are going. You know, Apple has signaled its intentions, you know, with a couple of potential deals that's rumored to be in the works and a couple of deals that it's said to have already done. So in terms of, you know, I think like a lot of companies, it's going to be trying to differentiate itself. How that will come, you know, we'll have to wait and see. But, you know, to a certain extent, you know, people can still choose to be behind that walled garden just because Apple is going to allow third-party app stores and third-party access doesn't mean that people have to actually use it. You know, they will still, I suppose, be able to say, you know, I only want to use Apple Music or I only want to use Apple Pay. There's going to be no obligation, I suppose, on consumers that to use all of these new entrants into the Apple ecosystem. But I think what people will have to get used to very quickly is figuring out what is a genuine Apple service and what is not, you know, and what's going to be a third party service. And that's where I suppose, you know, people will have to become a bit more savvy on that front as well, in the same way that we've had to start being a bit more wary about, you know, the text messages that we get. And, you know, not that I'm implying that anybody would, you know, abuse or that Apple would allow its platform to be abused. I do think that once you start opening up a walled garden, it does allow potential threats in. And in this case, obviously, Apple is doing it reluctantly. It's not doing it by choice. But, you know, there are going to be good parts and bad parts to this. And we're just going to have to learn to navigate it all as safely as possible.
Ciara Ryan of the Irish Times, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up in just a few minutes' time, John Fardy will be here with Screen Time. So make sure you stick around for that. Don't forget you can, of course, subscribe to this podcast and John's podcast on the News Talk app powered by Go Loud. But before we get to John, I want to delve into the mailbag because quite a few questions have come in to techtalk@newstalk.com. And the first one we have this week is from Dara. He says, hello, Jess. Hello. I hope you can answer a quick question for me. Roughly around a year ago, I heard you chatting with Pat Kenny and you mentioned that you felt the Honor 70 Lite was the best value Android phone for around the €200 mark. I duly bought the 70 Lite and have been very happy with it since. I'm delighted to hear that. My question, essentially the same. Which Android phone would you currently recommend for around €200? I don't mind going over a little if needs be. Our son is turning 13 and it appears time to succumb and give him a phone. I would have given him mine, but it's so battered and bruised, I couldn't do that to him. Dara, you're very welcome. And that is very nice that you're getting your kid his first phone. What I would recommend you do is go and buy a refurbished device, because 13, like, I don't think it's worth going out and buying a brand new phone at 13 years of age. Chances are it could break, it could get stolen, a million different things could happen. That was my teams going off there. Sorry, Dara, to be so rudely interrupted by my teams. Yeah, so what I would do is go to mintplus.ie or refurbed.ie are great. There's also swappy.ie. So there are a few different online outlets that sell refurbished devices. And they do have something for every price bracket. So go in and see what you can get for the money that you're hoping to spend. I really do think that a refurbished device is the way to go for the reasons I outlined. Also, they're much cheaper. Like my brother a little while ago was looking to get his hands on an iPhone. And rather than spending big bucks on a brand new one, he bought one from Swappy. And he's delighted with it. So I'm just on mintplus.ie now, and I see that they have a Galaxy S20, which is an excellent phone. That was a Samsung flagship a little while back from €219. You could also get the Galaxy S21 from €289. So there is excellent value to be had from the refurbished market. What I would recommend you do for your son, before you give him the phone, you set it up. And on your device or on your laptop, go to Google Family Link and set it up with you as the admin and then add an account for him. That will then give you elements of control around his screen time. It'll also give you an overview of the apps he's using and just put parameters in place. I think if you can take those steps before you hand the phone over, it's just much easier than retrospectively trying to do it, and it'll hopefully save you a headache down the line. So I hope that is helpful. Again, the websites are mintplus.ie, swappy.ie, although I think they just do iPhones, and then there's refurbed as well. So you've got a few different options there. Marty has been in touch on Instagram and he asks, what do you think of Garmin trackers, thinking of changing from Fitbit? So I don't have a Garmin, but Carl Henry, who was on the show a few weeks back talking about fitness trackers, I think he wears a Garmin. And I know Kieran Cudahy here in News Talk wears a Garmin as well. My question would be, why would you make the change? What is the Fitbit not doing for you? Personally speaking, I didn't love the Garmin app when I had a Garmin. I wear an Apple Watch SE and I just love it. Like that's the my Apple Watch is the reason I'm still using an iPhone. I just love the health tracker. I love the data it gives me. I love the way it displays the data. So that's my personal preference. The Garmin trackers, the Fitbit trackers, like it's getting increasingly difficult to buy a bad tracker, to be honest with you. But it comes back to what it is you want to do. If you're training for something specific and there's one tracker that will offer better metrics or better displays the data, then go for that. It's the same, and I know it's kind of frustrating, but I say the same thing when I'm talking about laptops or phones or cameras or whatever it is. What do you want the device to do? And then work back from there. I think it'll be much easier for you to find the right device once you know what your why is. The latest Fitbit, the Fitbit Charge 6, which is one I recommended a few weeks ago, it's one of the most affordable wearables out there at the moment. It's less than €150, but it has the most impressive technology built in. Like it has an ECG tracker, which my Notion's Apple Watch doesn't have. It has all of the Google Pay and the Google App functionality built in as well, because Google now owns Fitbit. I don't know that I would move from Fitbit to Garmin, but again, I don't know what your thought process is. If you want to get back onto me with more information and we can reconsider and reassess, you can do so for sure. But as I say, I would probably stick with Fitbit just on my previous experience of owning a Garmin. If you have any thoughts or feelings on what wearable to recommend, you can email me techtalk@newstalk.com, or if you have any tech questions that you want me to answer, that is the same email address. That's it from me for this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full on the News Talk app powered by Go Loud. I'll be back with Shane and Kira on Monday's News Talk Breakfast. But in the meantime, have a great weekend.